Welcome to episode 12 of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Vanderark. I'm the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website. And once again, we're going to take a look at the Harry Potter canon. We're going to be looking today at Book 5. I know we did Book 5 last time, but Book 5 is such an important book. It is such a crux point in the series that we've just got more to talk about. And that's even in an overview. It's interesting. I've did a podcast yesterday called the Alohomora podcast with MuggleNet. We recorded that yesterday, and we were talking just about two chapters of Book 1. And that, I mean, we kept going and going. We could have kept going well beyond what we did, but that just shows how much there is to discuss, how many details there are to find, even after all this time and looking at these things. And so to look at Book 5 and kind of an overview, the way we've been doing, is great, but we still have some more to talk about before, even in overview mode, before we can move on into Book 6. And it's going to be interesting to look at Book 6 after our discussion of Book 5, I think. But as I said, we're about halfway through, a little more than halfway through the series. We are going to be talking about Book 5 today, 6 in the next episode, 7 in the episode after that, I expect. And then we'll have to see where we're going to go from there. The podcast will, of course, continue. A couple of things to talk about before we get started with that. First of all, I've had a couple of people mention to me that Rowling has said that she was going to be publishing her encyclopedia as a book. And as a matter of fact, she did. That was what it said back in April on her new website. But now, as of May, it's been updated to say she's not planning to publish it as a book, but she is planning to put that material on Pottermore. Either way is great, as long as we get more of this lovely, wonderful canon information, I think is fantastic. The kind of information that she has to give us is unlike anything that we could put on the lexicon, anything that any of the fan sites or fan publications could possibly hope to come up with, because we just simply don't know all of that information. Although we are going to talk a little bit more about that, too, before we get into Book 5, we are going to talk a little bit about some of the things that have turned up. I frequently will take a look at various sources of Harry Potter canon and just kind of go through things, because I've been doing this for so long, and some of these sources, I've been listing canon sources for this detail or that fact, but it's been a long time since I've actually read through some of these interviews and things, and when I go back to them, it's fascinating. Some of them date from quite a few years ago. And to read them, to look at them now, and to kind of put them in the context of when they were given, and also in the context of what we know now, having the entire series at our disposal, is a fascinating thing. So we'll talk about that a little bit too. Before we do that, I wanted to point out that one of the great sources for all of this kind of information, for anything that if you're curious about where canon information, where things came from, the place to go is Accia Quote, which is Lisa Bunker's fabulous website, www.accio-quote.org. Just a rich storehouse of rolling interviews from all the way back to, I believe, the earliest ones, 97. And so just all of this stuff, and if you're reading in the lexicon, either in the lexicon book or on the lexicon website, you'll see references to these canon sources, and you might wonder, well, what in the world, where did that one come from? How do we know this little detail? And then you'll see a reference, and it's not, G.F. for Goblet of Fire or something, but it's some other strange, little abbreviation, and you don't know quite where that came from. Well, very likely, if you click on that on the website, it'll take you to the page that lists all these sources. And usually, if it's an interview, you'll be able to go and read that interview on Accio Quote. So if you're curious, if you're wondering where some of this information came from, some of this material came from, well, that's pretty much the source that I go to for that. And one of them, it's interesting, because I received an email, and I love email like this. Somebody had spotted on, I believe it was the entry for Harry Potter in the lexicon, and it listed his children, and listed Lily, his daughter Lily's middle name is Luna. And this email challenged that, said, now how do you know that? It said I've reread the epilogue, and I don't see anywhere where it says that her middle name is Luna. And it's interesting because the source for that is a thing, a sort of a television biography called J.K. Rowling, A Year in a Life. And we use the abbreviation YIL on the lexicon for that particular source. And so that source is where the middle name Luna came from. And so I sent an email back to this person. I said, no, this isn't just a fan invention. This is actually from something that Rowling has said. But my point, the reason I like those emails so much is that there is a lot of fan information out there. There's a lot of movie information. All of this it can be confusing. It can be confusing for a lot of people simply because they don't know which of these things is actually, as the email said, is this really from J.K. Rowling or is this something that fans have kind of come up with? Because it's difficult to tell. And especially if you go to some websites, which, just freely include all sorts of information from the films and from, various other sources like that, games and whatever, and just sort of lump it all together as if this is all of the same level of, I don't know, what do you want to say, authenticity or whatever. And I think for some people it is, and that's fine. That's a decision. And we've had this discussion over and over, even on this podcast. But, we on the Lexicon website and in the Lexicon book and in my reader's guide book, all these sources, places, I treat the information which comes directly from Rowling as being the real, and I use quotes here, Harry Potter. And but it's interesting because in this year of the life, because I rewatched it after I'd gotten that email, and I realized, I'd watched it when it first came out, which is a couple of years ago, 2007, I believe. And I watched it and just once, and they're done. For one thing, it didn't have a whole lot of new canon information in it, and as the lexicon person, that's really the thing that gets my attention the most. And so, the one thing that it did have, which is where the name Lily Luna came from, is it showed Rowling actually drawing, hand drawing a family tree for Harry and Hermione and Ron and so on and so forth with their children and everything. And this hand-drawn family tree is turned up in some other places too. We have it on the Lexicon website, for example, and it turned up on J.K. Rowling's website separately with Draco Malfoy's information added. And so all of that canon, that was about the only canon information that there was, but it was fascinating for me to hear some of the things that she said. The one line that really got me, when we're talking about what's canon, what's official, what's real, what can we look at and say, okay, this is the real, version of the Harry Potter story. This is one of the things that she said. She said, "I would like my version to be the official version, even if I've not written it in a book, because it's my world." And see, that is exactly where I'm coming from and where we came from when we did the lexicon. That the film is great and everything, but it is not the actual official version. Look at, here's an example of what I see a lot when people talk with me or when I hear see things written and so on. You'll get a lot of misinformation. People who just have interpreted things a certain way or have just kind of followed what they saw in the film and assumed that the film copied the book exactly when in fact it didn't. For example, you'll see a lot of people convinced that James was a seeker, which he was not. He was, at least according to Rowling, he was a chaser. But it shows him as a seeker in the film. And then people will say, well, they wouldn't have put it in the film if it wasn't correct. Well, that's not true. They put a lot of things in the film that aren't correct. And so, that's just one of those things where people are convinced that that's true, and they're convinced that they've seen it in the books somewhere. Well, what they probably are thinking of is the fact that James is seen in Snape's memory kind of flipping a snitch around and playing with a snitch as if he caught it in a match. But he never says that he did. Another thing is just the whole pronunciation of Voldemort. we know Rowling says Voldemort, not Voldemort, but in the film it's Voldemort. Jim Dale started saying Voldemort after the films came out, and so just about everybody assumes that it's Voldemort. And again, I think there's that assumption that, well, they wouldn't have done that in the film if Rowling hadn't said that that's what it was. But that's not true. That's not the way she worked with the films. In some ways, I think she was spot on. I mean, as an author, to find that balance of how much do you try to tell filmmakers what to do when they make your book into a movie, and how much do you let them do it, I think she tried to find that right balance. Now, somebody like me, who's, you know, really persnickety about all this canon stuff, I wish she'd been a little pickier. I wish she'd come and said, no, you can't do that. No, that doesn't work. No, you have to pronounce it like this. But she didn't. But there's other things, too. The film stuff like Ron being in the Forbidden Forest instead of Neville. I can't tell you how many times people have, you know, emailed me to tell me that the lexicon is wrong because of what we've put in there. And other, it's just a misunderstanding of what's there. For example, the line that Hagrid says that all, there wasn't a wizard that gone bad that wasn't in Slytherin. Well, a lot of people have taken that to mean that all the bad wizards in the wizarding world are Slytherins. And some have even gone so far as to say all Slytherins are bad wizards. Well, number one, it's Hagrid saying it. And Hagrid, you can go all through the books and find places where Hagrid doesn't know what he's talking about, or where he's hyperbolizing, or, you know, and things like this. And also, it just simply isn't logical that all Slytherins are bad, and all bad wizards are Slytherins, or all Slytherins are bad wizards. It just doesn't make sense for that to be. Obviously, he's you know, generalizing, and granted, a lot of bad wizards probably came out of Slytherin, but not all of them, and we've seen some pretty boorish, obnoxious characters in Gryffindor, haven't we? So, you know, and there's some other things, too, and this is, you know, we're kind of going back into this canon thing, and I guess maybe that's just a reaction to some emails that I've gotten lately, but I think it's worth bringing up, and it's worth keeping focused on. This is from something that she wrote in on Pottermore. If you get onto Pottermore, look for the little bit of extra information about something called ghost plots, which, again, very revealing. She said, I'm going to read, actually, some. This is something that she wrote about ghost plots. She says, I generated a mass of information about the magical world that never appeared in the books. I liked knowing these things, which was fortunate, given that I couldn't stop my imagination spewing it all out. And often, when I needed a throwaway detail, I had it ready, because of the background I had developed. Now, again, you realize what she's saying is not just that I just came up with a whole bunch of stuff and used some of it, didn't use others, which is true, I'm sure, that she hasn't used absolutely everything that she created. But what she is saying is that the end result of that process is a very, very solid knowledge of the wizarding world as she, her official version, that she wants it to be, even, as it says in Year in Life, she hadn't written it in a book. And so when in that whole ghost plots thing is talking about, she talks about developing storylines for other characters that didn't need to get included into the whole story, and that's what she calls ghost plots. But she says, and again, this is a quote from Pottermore, my private expression for all of the untold stories that sometimes seemed quite as real to me as the final cut is what she calls ghost plots. And again, the idea that in her mind this is a very, very real part of the Harry Potter canon, which is why, you know, we get all the way back to it, why you will see references on the lexicon to all of this stuff that she created. And we'll have to talk more about timelines again at some point, just because I've been going through the timeline on the lexicon, the last bit of it, I need some editing. Not that there's things that are wrong, but it just needs some last details added in. But I'm just struck again by the consistency of the Harry Potter timeline, the universe, the way that things develop and change. And so we were talking about that on that Alohomora podcast a little bit about the Wizarding Convention, or the convention in 1709 where dragons were outlawed, and how that connects to the 1689 or 1692, depending on where you fall on that. But that point when the Wizarding Secrecy kind of went into effect, that whole thing, The fact that there's even something to discuss and talk about and connect up there is fascinating, because that means that the timeline is not random. It's not just, you know, whatever, oh, just throw a date on there. But it actually does work. It does create a sweep of history. And I think that sweep of history is very important, because that sweep of history gives a genuine setting in terms of history for the saga. It fits into the historical record of the Wizarding World. It isn't just this, you know, completely isolated thing that turns up just in these books, and everything else is just sort of vague and random. So, anyway, moving on. Let's move on to Book 5. One more time, we're talking about Book 5. And again, what is the purpose of Book 5? I like to call it the chrysalis book. Chrysalis being, you know, the casing that a caterpillar goes into before it becomes a butterfly. And, we have Harry, who's in this change mode, who is in this crucible of taking away all the things he thought made him powerful and adding in all these new... not entirely. That's what makes this book so wonderful, is it doesn't just then replace those with all this other new stuff and then we're all good to go. Actually, it's so well written, this, as you go through Book 5, and this is why when you as a reader go through Book 5, you get to the point where it starts to turn, where, because it's so hopeless, the kids are so powerless, and yes, fairly soon he starts teaching the DA, and that is to some extent the turning point, but it isn't really, because they're still hiding and they're still completely at her mercy. They're just basically lucky to have found a place to practice, but they're still, the school is still very much under the control of Umbridge. And every time, something happens to help or to fight back a little bit, Dumbledore not allowing her to kick Trelawney completely out of the castle, for example, you right away get the impression that, yeah, there's one more little bit of power that she didn't realize she didn't have, but she will soon. And so all of those things, so many of those are little false starts, you might say. And so when it turns, which is, of course, the interview with the Quibbler, and where that turns, where that changes, and it suddenly starts to go the other way, it's just delicious. It is so satisfying, because the character and the situation is so dire. And you just know at that point that it's going to get better, and that it is getting better, and that things are good. And I remember reading it the first time. It was goosebumps, page after page, just so excited, just so thrilled to see it happening. And I don't know that any of the other books quite have that depth of relief, if you will, of delight. I mean, they're all wonderful, and they're all great, and I love all of them, and... You know, even in rereading, I really, really, really love all these books. But boy, that one, just what a fabulous, fabulous book, and the way it's plotted and the way it's constructed and the way it all comes together at the end. Now, here's the point. I'm sort of repeating myself so far, but here's the thing. I said last time there's one more major aspect that we really need to talk about, and that is... Well, let's go to the idea of these two worlds colliding, which is where the book starts. The Muggle world of the Dursleys and Harry's world of the magical world, where they start, the wall starts to break down. And you know, he starts to realize that, things were not as they seemed, or that the way things were is no longer the case. Well, that is also true for Rowling and for the fans. One of the things that happened back in the gap, we talked about that a couple of podcasts ago, one of the big things that happened, and I'm straying here into kind of my own suppositions, but I don't think I'm off the mark by far. One of the big things that happened was that Rowling changed her storytelling. She changed the way that she was telling her story. And part of it is inevitable because it's a series. And as a result, you are obviously going to have a change in as the book series goes along. Now, I say obvious because it's a series, but a lot of book series don't do this. But in the case of one like this, where the character with the story is really the whole series, not just book by book. I mean, you can read a lot of book series where each book is its own, and we've called it this before, like a television episode of a television series, and at the end everything is back the way it always is, and then the next episode, if you will, starts again, and it's, you know, nothing really changes. Well, with the Harry Potter series, things change all the time. Every book, big things change. In this case, the change also happened not just in the inevitable change because the story itself was changing, but it seems to me and that Rowling herself changed the way she wrote her books. We were talking on the Alohomora podcast. If you go all the way back to the first book, and you look at the chapters we were actually talking about then, which is chapters 13 and 14, Rowling has said that when she goes back and looks at some of at her books that she's written, she really wishes she could do some pretty major rewrite or edits or whatever. And I think that chapters 13 and 14 of Philosopher's Stone are an example of what she would really like to be able to go back and redo. Because I think she would want to redo them with the kind of approach she used for 5, 6, and 7. And the reason I say that is because if you look at chapters 13 and 14 in Philosopher's Stone, you will see example after example of things which are just not as carefully and deeply and consistently plotted. They're just thrown in there more to be a story. And here's an example. The Quidditch match, which is in chapter 13. In the Quidditch match, it happens at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, Quidditch never happens at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Quidditch happens at 11 o'clock in the morning, every other Quidditch match. Why did that one happen at 4 o'clock? And not just 4 o'clock, you have to realize it gets dark at 5:30. So they started a Quidditch match with less than an hour to play. Well, a lot of Quidditch matches go longer than an hour. I mean, that's standard, you know. Well, I don't know if standard once Harry got involved, but I mean, typically, you can't assume that a Quidditch match is going to be over anytime soon. And why in the world would they have started a match at 4 in the afternoon? Well, the only reason they did is because Rowling wanted to finish up that chapter with Harry at dusk getting on his broomstick and following Snape and Quirrell into the woods, into the Forbidden Forest. Which, by the way, is not called the Forbidden Forest, capital letter Forbidden, capital letter Forest. It's just called the Forest. At this point, she didn't have any problem with, you know, doing that sort of really, you know, glaringly obvious setup for a set piece because of the level she was writing. You know, she needed to get him into the forest. She didn't have an entire, you know, sort of history of Quidditch matches to fall back on, so there was no reason why she couldn't have a Quidditch match happen at 4 in the afternoon, and, you know, didn't think through the fact that it really didn't work out in terms of time and darkness and things, because it served the purpose of the ending of the chapter, which is Harry listening in on Snape and Quirrell's conversation. Now, does that matter? No, it doesn't matter to me at all. It's interesting to note, however, because it shows an example of Rowling writing at a level different from the level that she was writing with Order of the Phoenix or, you know, Half-Blood Prince and Deathly Hallows. If you look at those books, the level of plotting was so precise. And the reason was, partly, I think, because, well, she wasn't edited nearly as much. I mean, her editors basically left her alone to some extent. I mean, if you can analyze the writing and say, you know, an editor should have caught all of the adverbs and had her change some of those or whatever. We've had discussions about this in fandom for the last 10 years about the fact that, you know, Order of the Phoenix could have used a good editor. Well, I don't know. My attitude is I love it the way it is, but But I guess I can see that if you know, there's a lot of adverbs in there. But the point being that maybe that's one of the reasons why, without that outside influence, she could put it together the way she wanted to. But I think partly it is also, and this is kind of getting to the point here, I think that she, in that gap particularly, really became kind of aware, almost apprehensively aware, of fans. All of a sudden, she was realizing that, you know, she couldn't write in that kind of, you know, she couldn't get away with it, if you will, because when she had written that first book, she certainly wasn't ever imagining the kind of scrutiny that fans would give her writing and her story. I know from things she said in interviews and things, that was just a complete mind-boggler that people were going to be, you know, tearing into her writing and her books and finding things that were inconsistent or didn't work or should have been written differently or whatever. And the reason I bring that up, because I think that that's one of the reasons why the writing is so different in Order of the Phoenix, Half-Blood Prince, and Deathly Hallows, but also, it also explains a little bit why there was such a gap. But it also, I think, explains a few other things which some people have complained about when it comes to not so much Book 5, but Book 6, and especially Book 7. There was a lot of people who came back from those books and says, okay, wait a minute. Deathly Hallows, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Book 6, we've got all this tremendously important magic item, which, what, nobody's ever talked about this? You know, why do we have to go all the way to Book 6 before we even see anything about, not Deathly Hallows, but Horcruxes? Deathly Hallows, same story, Book 7. Why do we have to wait all the way to this point? It seems a little bit like if they're, these things are so important to this story and this plot, we should have been told about them earlier. Why did this Deathly Hallows, why isn't there back in Book 1 or Book 2 some reference to the Tales of Beedle the Bard so that, you know, it doesn't seem so much like it's just being, you know, inserted, you know, out of nowhere into those later books? Well, okay, to be fair, I don't think she'd invented Tales of Beedle the Bard when she was writing Book 1, okay? A lot of stuff got invented as she went along. I mean, if there was such a thing, good and pretty simple example is Sidelong Apparition. So you've got Sidelong Apparition. So why didn't they use Sidelong Apparition in earlier books? You've got a number of situations like this where things are invented in later books, and then you go back to the earlier books and say, well, why didn't they use that here? Well, we can come up with reasons within the wizarding, you know, within the Harry Potter stories themselves, but basically the reason is exactly what you think. She invented that for this book and hadn't thought it up yet back then. Well, I think what happened with things like the Horcruxes in Book 6, I think we might have gotten more hint of that. I remember Book 6 and Book 2 are actually mirrors of each other. I think by the time she got to Book 5, she was starting to think in terms of, I've got to withhold. I've got to pull back. I can't even give the slightest hint because people are going to figure this stuff out. People are going to work this out. And so why did the Deathly Hallows not appear already in Book 5 or Book 6? Because she realized that if we would have heard about the Deathly Hallows in Book 5, we would have been going absolutely bonkers on this stuff. We would have figured everything out. We would have worked everything out. We would have, or you know, and instead she thought, no, these, whereas maybe if this book series had been what I thought it was going to be, which is just this, you know, kind of obscure series of books maybe a few people will like, and, you know, just then maybe we would have heard about Deathly Hallows earlier. Maybe we would have heard about Horcruxes earlier. And you can argue that we did hear about Horcruxes already in Book 2, but you know what I'm saying. But I think that she, starting with Book 5 and Book 6 and Book 7, was in a different mode. And that different mode was, okay, I've got to start revealing things now. All of these mysteries that people have been writing and talking and debating about since 1997, and now it's 2002, 2003, people have been, you know, really going to town on this. I've got to start giving some of that back. I've got to start answering some of the questions. I can't save absolutely everything for the seventh book, but how in the world do I do that without giving just that wrong clue that just sets everybody off, gets everybody upset, people solve the whole question. I mean, how do you continue to write Snape the way that she did? I mean, if you look at the way Snape is written in Book 6, masterfully done. Because we got to the end of Book 6, and no way could we find an answer to the question of where did his loyalties really lie. Oh, we all had our predictions and our suppositions, but there was no way that we could actually say for certain. And that is a credit to her writing, all the way from Book 1. The only one where I really have some problems is Book 3. There, I think if she was going to, again, talk about editing, I think she would look at Book 3 and say maybe some of that end of that book needs to be edited a little. But the point is that things changed with Book 5. Her writing changed with Book 5. And it isn't just the lack of whimsy, because there is that, but it's also a sense of her being an author of a world-known phenomenon. And so the stories have that sense to them. And the storytelling has that combination of, okay, we're going to start answering some questions, but at the same time, I'm going to have to keep pulling things back. I'm going to have to be even more cagey about it. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why Order of the Phoenix is my favorite. Because, especially on rereads, you just see how masterfully she does it. How she gives us this incredible, incredible story, and drags her poor hero through this horrible situation, but brings him out at a point where you just are so delighted with the way that he pulls it together. You are given this incredibly satisfying ending to the story. And all of that in that context of this being this chrysalis book, where Harry is becoming this new person. He is becoming the hero that he's going to be in Book 6. And then, as we move into Book 6, what's going to happen now is we are going to see what we've not seen so far in Book 5. We've seen everything taken away. We've seen that corner turned. We've seen the beginning of happiness, if you will. And then, now we're going to get Book 6. And I there are people who have a big, huge problem with Book 6. They think it's boring. They think it's, compared to 5 or whatever, they don't. 6 is like, whatever. It's a whole lot of talking, a whole lot of, I've heard that. I've gotten emails to that effect. Oh, just wait. Because when we look at Book 6, in the context of Book 5, and in the context, in some ways, of Book 7, but mostly in the context, as a continuation of Book 5, we see Book 6. And next time around, we will really dive into that and look at the purpose of Book 6, how Book 6 becomes, in some ways, the ending of the process that starts in Book 5, and in other ways, just the fruition of it. In other words, the reward of Book 5, in some ways, the moments of happiness before the catastrophe of Book 7. So we'll take a look at that next time. Before we keep going, though, there was something that I came up with, and this comes out of my own being honest with you here. And, you know, I've said this, and I put it on my Facebook page, which is some of what I'm going to reference right now, because it has some wonderful responses. I'm one of these people who says, okay, I'm going to reread the series. I'm going to reread the whole thing through. I'm ready. I'm going to do it. And I'll pick up Book 1, and sure enough, I either don't finish Book 1. Well, book runs pretty short. I can usually whip through that in an evening. But I find myself basically bogging down, and I don't get it done. And I'll maybe listen to part of the recorded, you know, the audiobook, but then I don't listen to the whole thing because it's a lot of hours. And what I thought was, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to reread the whole series, what would be the if you were just going to choose chapters, I'm going to read this chapter and this chapter and this chapter as representative of particularly good chapters, particularly important, important to the saga, to the story. So not necessarily just because they're the most fun. Because obviously I love to read, you know, the Fred and George leaving Hogwarts. But honestly, if you're talking in terms of the saga, that one is not so important. But if you look at, I mean, one for me is Philosopher's Stone is in Philosopher's Stone is chapter 12, which is the Mirror of Erised. And of course, I have I find that chapter endlessly fascinating, partly because I keep wondering where Dumbledore was hiding the stone. And we've talked about that ages ago, but just, you know, that whole mystery, and the whole mystery of how much Dumbledore was managing things and making things go the way that he wanted to. I see it really come out in that chapter. But also just the fact that that chapter is one which is so, it just gets your heart. And that moment when Harry looks in that mirror and says, "Mom," it's goosebump time. I mean, I don't care how many times you read it. That's just fantastic, and it moves things ahead. And I would just say, if you're gonna pick up Philosopher's Stone, you say, "Okay, I'm gonna read part of it. What am I gonna read?" I don't know that I need to read all of the Dursley scenes again. I think those are pretty much imprinted in my brain. I would say it's worth reading. Certain scenes that really are, I think, exciting. In chapters 13 and 14, I don't know that I would read those. I just did, and I loved them, but, you know, those are not so much moving the plot ahead. The whole thing with Hagrid and the dragon, it's insane. It's so completely doesn't make sense, or if it is true, Hagrid really should be in, you know, taken to task and removed from the school. Yeah, it's crazy. Not that he has a dragon, because that I believe, but the fact that he, you know, involves, you know, these three first years, 11-year-old kids in his craziness, and not only that, but then when they get caught fixing his problem, he lets them take the fall for it. It's just, you know, I have problems with that. But be that as it may, to reread chapter 12, to me, is wonderful. Now, there are other ones. The chapter 17, The Man with Two Faces, just for that conversation with Voldemort, to once again get that sense of, you know, where things stand in the plot at this point, I think is important. But I'm going to just read a couple other things that some people put on my Facebook page when they were responding to this and making suggestions of what it is that they would suggest that you would read if you wanted to choose a chapter. One person, Mary Ailes, said, "My favorite, which gets me rereading the books every time, is from The Prisoner of Azkaban, chapter 17. For me, it changed everything." And this is where the rat becomes a wizard. And I think for most of us, and again, we've talked about this, but you just cannot emphasize enough what a huge difference that chapter, that bit of Prisoner of Azkaban, how much that changed everything, how much that changed the way we read the books, the way we read the two books that came before, the way we read Goblet of Fire, the way that we've read every book since. It all came down to that scene. Where Sirius says, "That's not a rat," croaked Sirius Black suddenly. "What do you mean? Of course he's a rat." "No, he's not," said Lupin quietly. "He's a wizard." "An animagus," said Black, "by the name of Peter Pettigrew." And so, bingo. See, that's that moment. And if you're just going to read a few chapters here and there, you've got to read that, I think, because that brings back all of, you know, what it is to read the Harry Potter books. But, you know, I mentioned this before. Snape, in that section, what is going on with him? His behavior in that chapter is so out of control and so crazy and so, the nasty viciousness. And you think, well, yeah, remember the way he was treated. I know, but think about Snape, who we now know as this complete character, as we now know what he was doing and protecting Harry. And would any of that really make him act like, I mean, literally, he should be committed. I mean, he's that out of control and out of his mind at that point. That just doesn't fit my idea of Snape. And if you're thinking of the film, no, go read the book. read that section. But maybe that's why it's important to read, because we have a very, you know, our vision of Snape as a character has turned into a vision of Alan Rickman in a robe. But Snape in the books is more than that. And Alan Rickman does a fabulous job of portraying Snape. And I'm not in any way trying to suggest that he should not have had that part. I think he's perfect. But, as is always the case, there's more in the book than there is in the film. And to read that particular section, I think, assuming we have to accept that as part of canon, we are talking about a character who is a lot more flawed, maybe, a lot more unstable than we typically think. And I think it's worth reading for that, if nothing else. But no, just for the simple fact that we're talking about that moment in the reading of the saga where we suddenly realize that Rowling was writing a lot more story than we gave her credit for, and to go back and to dig and to try to find other clues and other things. It's absolutely a critical moment. And it's interesting. This is another quote from my Facebook page. This one is kind of an opposite. In fact, she says, I know it's the opposite of what you asked, but I nearly always skip Sectum Sempra. Now, that is interesting, because that is the scene, of course, if you're not quite sure, in Half-Blood Prince, where Harry encounters Draco crying in the bathroom, and Harry fires off this spell, which he learned from the Half-Blood Prince's book, not realizing the violence of that spell. How much violence that would be. I mean, it literally almost killed Malfoy. And I understand that is a difficult chapter for a lot of people, because of the fact that Draco, for one thing, is seemingly out of character, although some people would think that finally we get to see a little depth to his character. But in some ways, yeah, he's not acting like the Draco we expect, but I think he is, in fact, acting like the Draco that he has become. If you think about what what he's going through and what the pressure he's undergoing in that book and in the story at that point. And I think to see him become vulnerable and then to see Harry become Draco, to become the one who whips out his wand and fires off an incredibly violent spell to his enemy. This person who has been his tormentor and his enemy for 6 years, it comes to a head at this point. This is so critically important, though. And I guess why I would say, I understand why somebody would maybe say, I don't want to read it. But where I would say, this is a critical chapter. You need to read it because you need to see the relationship between Draco and Harry come to a head at that point. We needed to have that crash of personalities get resolved in that way, where Draco... we see him finally as more than just the stereotype he is in the opening books, where he's just the bad kid that we're all supposed to dislike. I mean, we are encouraged to have prejudice against Draco Malfoy and the Slytherins in the books, even though supposedly the whole theme of the books, or one of the big themes of the books, is tolerance and acceptance and all this kind of thing, and second chances and all this. Well, but that's not the message we're given. We're given the message that intolerance and prejudice and even nastiness are great, as long as you're aiming them at certain people, which I don't know that was an intentional theme, but unfortunately it is a big theme that's in especially the earlier books. Now, why is that in there? Because those books are written, all the books are, but those in particular are written in that genre, that schoolboy genre of British, children's literature, where you've got a kid at school, and the school always has these stereotypical bad kids, and they always are supposed to get their comeuppance at the end. That's the way it works. Well, Rowling, in this case, in that chapter in Sectum Sempra, is taking that idea and actually kind of turning it on its head and saying, okay, that's all great. We all feel that way. We all say, yeah, these are the bad kids. Yeah, these kids need to be taught a lesson, et cetera, et cetera. But when Harry gets finally to that point and he is going to do that. He's facing his enemy, and he's going to use that violent, nasty spell. And that is the last piece that's taken away from him, in a good way. And now we're starting to get into book six in more general. But just think about the fact that he needs to learn that the way to defeat your enemy, truly defeat your enemy, is not violence. And how is he going to learn that? By just somebody telling him that? Of course not. If that would have happened, we would have been crying foul. I'm sorry. You don't just tell somebody, oh, by the way, you got to be nice. And therefore they are, and therefore they win. You know, we'd all say, oh, that's pretty shallow. No. He's got to learn this. And he does. He learns it because here he has this sort of rehearsal for facing Voldemort, and he tries it the old way. And it doesn't work. It does, but he realizes quickly that that's not the right way to deal with things. That's not going to do it. That's not what he wants. It's not right. It's not him. And he takes that book and he hides it away and no, that's not who I am. In a sense, he's saying, and he doesn't realize it, but he's saying, I'm not Snape. I'm not dark. I'm not a Slytherin. I'm not a dark wizard. I'm not going to do it. And that goes away, that hides away, and you know, we'll talk next time more about book six and about Snape in book six, but the point is that I understand not wanting to read that chapter, but I think it's a critical chapter to read if you're reading along and trying to just read the pieces that'll kind of help you put it all together. Now, if you've got other suggestions for, you know, which chapters would be the ones to read. I'm going to start kind of collecting these suggestions and things and put a document together to put on I'll probably put it on Facebook. Maybe I'll even kind of turn into a series of essays or something. I don't know, but it'd be kind of fun to have this kind of a, okay, I want to read through the series. I don't have time to read all, you know, a million plus words. Instead, I'm going to just read these chapters, and here's the ones that everybody kind of together, we've all kind of agreed are good ones to go with, if you will. So, if you've got any suggestions on that, as we've already got the comment that I put on the Facebook page already has 30 or so comments on it, so maybe I'll start another one and find some other, maybe narrow it down to book by book or something like that, because I really would like to kind of hear what everybody thinks on that score. And we'll bring up more of those again next time. We'll talk about some other good examples and good suggestions and why they're particularly important. One other thing to talk about before we move, kind of let this one go, is in book five. Let me tell you how this started. I put a poll on the Facebook page, asking who is the most intriguing non-wizard character in the series, and I put a couple of choices: Ferenczi and Creature and. I forget who else, but it was interesting to me because my assumption was going to be that the answer everybody would want to give is Dobby. And so I didn't put Dobby on as a choice. I figured, you know, because you can add on those polls on Facebook, you can actually add additional choices. And somebody added the Sorting Hat and things like this. So I know people were adding them, but nobody added Dobby, which did surprise me because I figured he would be the number one choice. But I was really surprised to see that the number one choice on that poll was Ferenczi. And I was talking with my wife about that, and I thought, I don't understand why that one was chosen. And we got into this big discussion about characters. And I do want to talk a little bit about Ferenczi and why she explained to me, I think, a really good reason why Ferenczi people thought was so intriguing. And we'll talk about that next time, since we're going to be talking about book six next time anyway. But we got into this and kind of shifted our discussion to Molly Weasley. And that ties in more with book five, because I have to admit, I'm not a Molly Weasley fan. Well, I mean, you can't help but like her to some extent, but I just didn't care much for the character of Molly Weasley. The way that she was written seemed to me to be sort of shallow. Her, you know, getting so easily swayed by reading in the which weekly or daily prof or whatever, about Hermione supposedly breaking Harry's heart, and then she just buys this and gives Hermione a smaller Easter egg because of it. And I thought, oh my goodness me, come on, have some brains. Are you that lame that you can't, especially after what happened in book four, you don't see the press for what it is? And there were things like that. And also just all of book five, she just seems like just this crabby person who's constantly upset and mean to people and angry with people, and sometimes deservedly so and sometimes not. But I just really didn't care much for her character. And I almost felt like, the kind of whatever everybody would say is the vindication at the end of book seven was like, yeah, okay, great. You're kind of trying to save this character after, basically five books of character assassination. That's how I took it. So we had this conversation this morning over breakfast and just discussing characters. And she brought up Molly because she knows that that's a character that I have talked about in this way before. And she said, think of it another way. And I'm going to kind of tell you, I think this is a wonderful way to look at it. We know Rowling has mother issues, okay? And we know that's true, and obviously, she's talked about this a lot, and so in some ways, Molly Weasley is the ultimate mother figure for Harry. She is, his surrogate mother basically through the series, but also. And this came out of our discussion this morning, for Joe. I think Joe is trying to kind of paint the picture of the ideal mother. And you think, well, okay, ideal mother means being, crabby all the time, or ideal mother means you got to, stay, do the cooking and the cleaning, and that's it? That's all you get to do? That seems a little bit, should we say antiquated? Way of looking at things. I mean, why doesn't she get to go out and do stuff and be on guard duty and all this kind of thing? Well, and here's where we came down on it this morning. What Molly realizes and what Rowling is trying to make sure that comes through is that there is another kind of strength here. That is the strength that comes from having the security of that home, and I say home here with a capital letter. Molly Weasley creates home, creates safe haven, creates comfort, if you will. And if you look at, for example, she knits these sweaters, which are in some ways a little bit funny, but in some ways too, think about these sweaters as being this very, very intimate thing that she does for her family. She makes them clothes. She takes care of them. She makes them food. In some ways, we as parents all wish that we could do that, that we could just spend our time just making sure everything was right and perfect for our kids. And I'm not talking about coddling them or spoiling them. I'm saying just we wish that we had the time to be home when they get home from school every day. We wish that we had the time to always make them the perfect meal. We wish that we had the time to do them the perfect birthday party every year. We wish that we had the time to do all of these things. And modern life being what it is, there's none of us, practically, who really feels like we get to do that, who can do that. Molly can. Molly does. And you can call it old-fashioned if you want to, but in Harry's life, in Harry's development from being superhero Harry, where he didn't really need Molly, she turns up to watch the tournament, but he's on his own here. And then you get through book five and book six, and all of a sudden you've got that mother figure coming to the fore in book five. And yes, you see her agony at having to watch her family be in mortal peril, walking around with that clock and just desperately doing everything that she can. And think about what their lives would have been like if she wasn't doing it. It would have been like the camping trip in book seven. The camping trip in book seven is not, ideal. It was necessary, but that's not what he had in his darkest hour. When Harry was facing this incredible transformation and all the pain that it brought, he had Molly Weasley creating a home for him and a family for him and that love and support. And again, think about the fact he is turning into now the new Harry, the new hero, the new character, the new person who is able to take on Voldemort. And that is going to happen because of all of these factors which are going to come together and help him to, you know, whatever you want to call it, blossom into this new person. And what is the absolute underlying attribute of this new Harry is love. And we know that because of so many things in the book, but where is he learning love? Not from the Dursleys, obviously. Where is he learning to love people? I mean, he spent all of Book 5 avoiding people, staying away from people. When he was sure that he had to go to the ministry to rescue Sirius, he rejected the help of people. He didn't want to listen to Hermione. And Hermione was, harping on him, which is in some ways very hard to read. But that was, in some ways, Hermione was the Molly substitute there to try to help him to understand the larger picture, and he rejected it. He rejects all of that, and he's going to be the hero again in Book 5 when it all falls apart. And now, the ending of Book 5 is absolutely critical when we talk about the change in Harry, and not just the argument with Dumbledore in his office, but also then the next days when he deals with the death of Sirius. And all of this changes as he starts to become the Harry of Book 6, and we'll talk about that next time. And the character of Molly being written the way she was is critical to that. And that strength of love, strength of love, it's exactly the point. The strength of love is what's so important and what Molly Weasley represents. And so I think, my take on Molly Weasley was short-sighted, was wrong. And I think that that's a much better way to look at it. And I'm excited about that. And we'll talk about Ferenczi next time. Why Ferenczi? So many people thought he was the most intriguing character. As we talk about Book 6, we'll also talk about Ferenczi. But I think we better wrap this up for now. We've done Book 5 for 2 episodes in a row, which means next time we will be moving into Book 6, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Harry of Book 6, the purpose of Book 6. Remember to take Book 5 with you as we go into our discussion of Book 6, because you need to see that as a flow. All of these we do, but it's particularly important as you look at this new Harry being born and appearing in Book 6. As always, if you want to join in on the conversation, things like which chapters you think are key to read, if you're going to try to do a partial reread, go ahead for the Facebook fan page. You can find a link for that in the show notes, which are on the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast website, which is www.hp-lexicon.org. If you click on the podcast link, you'll find show notes and some links to places in the lexicon, and so where you can find more information. Also, if you want to send me an email, steve.lexicon@gmail.com is my email address. Feel free to shoot off an email. I have to admit that during the school year, I got way behind on email, and I've been, for the last week or so, been trying to dig my way through some of the past emails that I've gotten. So if you never got a response from me, I do apologize. Unfortunately, that's inevitable, given everything that goes on in my life during the school year. But I am trying to get up with some of those there. And if you sent me an email, never got a response, and really would like to get a response, feel free to email me again, because I am keeping up on my current email now. Follow me on Twitter, lexicon_Steve, for Twitter. Also, on Google Plus, there's a fan page there as well for the Lexicon, and I'm looking at doing a hangout on Google Plus coming up soon, because the Lexicon book is now finished as in ebook format. It is going to be released coming up on the Kindle and the Nook very soon. I will be posting on Facebook and Twitter, and so when the date is that that's going to go live, I don't know yet. I'm still have another editor looking it through to make sure that I didn't miss any of the little glitches and things like this, which seem to inevitably pop up whenever you transfer from one format to another. So, but I hope you get a chance to take a look at that if you're interested in getting a copy of the Lexicon book, which, of course, is not the same as the Lexicon website. A lot of information is different in the book, or is additional, I should say, in the book. Yesterday did the Alohomora podcast. It's supposed to go live, I believe, on July 1 of 2012. So if you are interested in hearing more canon discussion, that's definitely the place to go. We had a great time on that that podcast. I just absolutely love discussions like that with fans talking about canon and theories and ideas. And one idea came out of that, which is one that I've been kind of bumping around in my head for quite a few years now, and it really kind of came together in the conversation on that podcast. And I think I might set aside some time in the next episode or two to talk about that a little bit. I call it the theory of convergence, which is just my fancy way of saying it's the idea that I came up with and I needed to call it something. But do check out MuggleNet's Alohomora podcast. I'll put the link in the show notes for that. And if you are interested, the books, electronic book version of the Reader's Guide to the Philosopher's Stone is available on the Nook and on the Kindle. And you will soon find the Lexicon on there. And there's, of course, the Lexicon is available as a hard copy, which is always nice to be able to pick it up and look through it. I look through it all the time. And even though I wrote the thing, I keep finding things that I'd kind of half forgotten. So do check that out as well. You can get it on Amazon or wait for the Kindle version if that's what you're looking for. And I guess that about wraps it up for now. Keep your eyes open on the Facebook page and on Twitter if you're interested in any of the upcoming events, which would be the Hangout and the release of the new book. And I guess that about takes care of it. So thanks again to Harry and the Potters for the use of the music for the podcast. And this is Steve Vanderark of the Harry Potter Lexicon. Thanks for listening.